From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. A community is in mourning as the work week gets underway in Virginia Beach, the latest site of a mass shooting in the United States. A city worker there killed 12 people Friday in a municipal building after submitting his resignation letter. The gunman was killed in a shootout with police, and they're still investigating his motive. Joining us now from Virginia Beach is NPR's Bobby Allen. Bobby, what is it like there today, now a couple days after the shooting?
You know, I got to emphasize here, Jeremy, that people have a connection to the shooting beyond the obvious, which is that it happened in their community. And the connection is that it happened on this huge city government park. It's like this huge city government lot where people in Virginia Beach, I mean, they go there to get their driver's license. You vote there. You pull building permits. So the fact that, you know, that's the building where, you know, citizens complete kind of like everyday government tasks, mm-hmm. and where public servants come to, you know, work every day, that was transformed into a violent crime scene. Yeah, that exacted a toll, and people are still talking about it.
Well, to that point, they're going to open some parts of the campus this week, right?
So it's a pretty sprawling campus, and there's more than 30 buildings. Almost all of them are going to open tomorrow. So government work will resume tomorrow, except for building number 2. That's still an active crime scene being investigated by the FBI and local and state authorities.
Well, tell us more about what investigators are saying at this point about what exactly happened and whether there is any idea of what the motive might have been.
So just as work was winding down Friday, the gunman stormed into this municipal building, swiping his work badge, right? Just like he would any other day of work. He had 2 handguns on him. He was also carrying these high-capacity ammunition magazines and this device called a suppressor. It kind of like muffles the sound of the gun. And Jeremy, he just began indiscriminately spraying bullets on 3 different levels of this building. And workers told me they were scrambling to find cover. I talked to some survivors who barricaded themselves in rooms and hunkered down and just prayed that they would make it out alive. And the whole time, survivors told me the gunman never said a word. He was completely silent. And he just kept shooting indiscriminately. And in the end, 11 government workers and 1 contractor were left dead.
And still pretty unclear at this point why.
Right. So the main question of the investigation is, why did this happen? And the reason why it is a especially puzzling question is because officials say there's no reason to believe at this point that he was disgruntled, that he had any tension, that there was any drama between him and any colleague. He submitted a letter of resignation to his boss over email just hours before the shooting, but officials said it was brief. There was nothing about motive in there. He basically just said he's tendering his resignation. There was no reason to believe this was going to happen. There was no warning signs.
Let's listen to one of the people that you spoke with, one of the survivors of the shooting. This is Christy Dewar, who barricaded herself in a room during the shooting, but when she first heard about the gunman, she had this reaction.
The city has classes on active shooting, and when the 3 women from the front came running in saying active shooter in the building, we all thought it was a drill.
You can hear the emotion in her voice there. And of course, now this is something that we've heard in shooting after shooting after shooting across this country of people that thought that it was a drill, and in fact, it wasn't a drill. Bobby, are people talking about guns as they do often after these kinds of events?
The only people talking about guns, as far as I can tell, you know, are federal investigators, and they just talk about it in a matter-of-fact way. You know, they recovered 2 45 caliber pistols and the other devices that I already mentioned. But besides that, the community members aren't focused on firearms or, you know, gun policy debates at this point. The real focus is just on getting the families of victims the support they need. That's really what everyone's talking about.
So, Bobby, as we approach 3 days since this shooting, what is the community doing to try to support the survivors that we've been hearing from and the victims' families?
there are multiple funds that have been set up to support victims' families, and money has really been pouring in from around the world, which is really heartening to the Virginia Beach community. The city, you know, they set up these special coordinators who are going to help link families with counseling and other services like helping get their loved ones buried. You know, I've heard of community members who are stepping up, like pastors who are doing sort of like ad hoc counseling sessions. I've heard about people having like one-on-one sessions with therapy dogs with some of the families of victims, because you know, anything right now to help get their minds off this turmoil is something that will be welcomed.
It's NPR's Bobby Allen joining us from Virginia Beach. Bobby, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, let's go overseas now, where President Trump got a dignified royal welcome in the UK today, accepting a gift from the Queen, attending memorial at Westminster Abbey, after a rather undignified Twitter storm, the president insulting London's mayor and the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. Back in the States, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, made waves in an interview on HBO yesterday. So let's check in with NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
And let's start with the Duchess. Before she married a prince back in 2016, she was on a late night show and called Trump misogynistic and divisive. Then the Sun newspaper asked the president about that. Let's listen.
She said she'd move to Canada if you got elected. Turned out she moved to Britain.
Well, that would be good. I mean, there are a lot of people moving here. So what can I say? No, I didn't know that she was nasty.
I didn't know she was nasty. But on June 2nd, Trump tweeted he never called Meghan Markle nasty. That was made up by the fake news media, he wrote, and they got caught cold. Well, CNN, New York Times, others apologized, doubt it. This even after he tweeted out a clip of him saying Meghan Markle was nasty. What's the White House saying?
Well, the White House hasn't had much to say about this. Typically with things like this, it's always the tweet kind of speaks for itself. I think the most generous assessment that you could kind of give to this is he was saying he didn't know that Markle had been nasty about him, not that he thinks that she is a nasty person. But that is not clear from what he said. And that's why politicians usually try to be very clear about what they mean, or you can cause controversy.
Well, he also called the liberal Muslim London mayor Sadiq Khan a stone-cold loser, said that the British MP Boris Johnson, who some Brits refer to as a school bully, should be prime minister, and Nigel Farage, leader of the Brexit Party, should negotiate Brexit. How's this going over, these comments on, you know, domestic there politics?
You know, I think you are seeing there are some protests going on in the UK with Trump's visit. And obviously, the people of the UK, Trump doesn't seem to be super popular over there. But I think that when it comes to the actual alliance, that remains intact. Like, the UK is going to need allies, particularly the US, if it goes through with Brexit. And what really kind of tests these alliances is not so much like stuff that President Trump says, although they may not welcome it. It's just the kind of actions that he can take that can be very unpredictable. So if you have a trade deal with the U.S., will the Trump administration stick to that, or will they change that kind of like they did with Mexico and put tariffs on all your products? It's that kind of unpredictable actions that really are kind of testing these alliances.
Well, then to the interview from the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. We don't often hear from Kushner, but in this interview on Axios on HBO. He was pushed by the host, Jonathan Swan, about the Trump administration's decision to cut aid to the Palestinians. Now, remember, Kushner has been charged with coming up with a plan for Middle East peace. Let's listen.
With regards to the Palestinian people, I do believe that they want to have a better life. And I do think that they're not going to judge.
I don't mind the aid being cut.
Well, they're not going to judge anything based on trusting me or trusting anyone else. They're going to judge it based on the facts and then make a determination. Do they think this will allow them to have a pathway to a better life or not?
And just, can you read anything into that exchange about the White House position on Middle East peace?
This seems to be kind of a part of this calculation from the administration that Palestinians will accept a number of concessions or accept a number of kind of sacrifice things that are kind of important to them in exchange for this idea of a lot of financial gain or investments. And that seems to be the first part of this plan that's really taking shape, is this idea that there'll be a lot of kind of financial investments to kind of help the Palestinians get on board. But it's just not clear whether that will actually work. Administrations have obviously obviously been working on this issue for decades without success, and doing things like moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, cutting aid, that makes getting the Palestinians on board a very tall order.
Yeah, well, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has called the peace plan into question. The Washington Post reporting that he said one might argue that the plan is unexecutable, so they're this might be a sign that the administration is divided on its merits. But we want to ask you about something else from the interview. Jonathan Swan, also pressed Kushner on Trump's promotion of the false birther conspiracy theory. He really ginned it up. This is President Trump. And this is the lie, of course, that Barack Obama wasn't born in the U.S. Let's listen.
Was birtherism racist? Look, I wasn't really involved in that.
I know you weren't. Mm-hmm. Was it racist?
Like I said, I wasn't involved in that.
I know you weren't. Mm-hmm. Was it racist?
Look, I know who the president is, and I have not seen anything in him that is racist. So again, I was not involved in that.
Did you wish he didn't do that?
Like I said, I was not involved in that. That was a long time ago.
I guess we gather he was not involved with that. But the administration can't be wanting this conversation in a run-up to another election.
It doesn't seem like it's something that they want to be talking about. I think what stands out about that answer is that he wouldn't answer the question of whether he approved or disapproved of these actions and really try to distance himself from that.
Not involved in that. That's NPR White House reporter Ayesha Rascoe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave. Control your comfort.
It is almost summer, which means it's almost the season for highway construction projects. The country's interstate highway system was established in 1956, and those roads, especially in urban areas, now carry many times more vehicles than they were designed to carry. Maintaining and improving them is also harder while they're being used by all those cars. Joining us now is Brian Palish, Managing Director of Government Relations at the American Society of Civil Engineers. He's in Washington. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And when we look around the country right now and some of the big interstate projects that are going on, a 10-mile stretch of I-70 through Denver, about $1 billion project right there, 35-mile portion of I-94 in and near Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and its airport, 21 miles of I-4 through Orlando, Florida, that's a $2 billion project. Is there a lot more construction going on right now than usual?
Well, I think what we're seeing is it is construction season, right? So it stopped snowing and it's gotten warmer. And so now it's time to start rebuilding those roads and doing the projects that have been planned and improve accessibility, relieve some congestion, and improve safety.
And I imagine that if you had your way and if the people that look at this very closely had their way, there would be a lot more construction projects going on right now because the highways need them.
We've taken a generation off of investing in our infrastructure, and I think our interstate highway system demonstrates that by not only the congestion that we see, which we're not going to be able to necessarily solve all the congestion problems, but also simply the condition of the roads. The mm-hmm. roadways that we drive on every day put quite a toll on our vehicles. The average driver, if you will, faces about $600 in vehicle repairs and maintenance in a given year just from the roadway system that damages it. There is a toll to what we're doing, if you will, by not maintaining our roadway systems.
Are there safety issues that come along with that? Do you think that the roads, the highways at this point, are unsafe in some places?
I think there's a number of factors, right? So I was driving in this morning, as I do from Alexandria, Virginia, and I was watching a driver next to me watch a movie as he was driving him and his son somewhere. Distracted driving is a significant issue, and lots of states have been focused on that. But roadway condition also plays a role. If there's a pothole and your car hits that pothole, you may not be able to react in time and maybe your car veers or something like that. So I think there are some roadway safety issues with regards to to the condition of the road that may contribute to some of the crashes that we have.
Okay, so let's get to what's going on to try to update these highways and repair these roads. It is a lot harder now to do that in some places because these highways may have been built where there was nothing around, and now they're surrounded by buildings and, you know, cities have grown and suburbs have grown. How much more difficult does it make repairing the highways to have all that stuff around now?
You know, I think it provides quite a bit of challenges many times for engineers and contractors. It is a difficult problem that they have. Not only, yes, there are buildings right nearby, and if you're going to expand, for example, the highway, you're going to add a lane or two. Well, that's a problem because you may have a limited amount of space, and that may be difficult to do. But also, you've got so many more vehicles, as you noted, going through a given area that now you're going to start rebuilding that roadway and maybe taking out a lane so that you can start rebuilding or taking out two lanes. You also have this problem of, you know, there's utilities that are involved in this. So there's sewer lines and water mains and storm drains and electrical wires, fiber optic cables that many times run through the right-of-way of these roadway systems or run across them. And so a lot of the utilities have to be reworked or relocated. These are pretty massive projects, all the while trying to ensure that the traveling public gets to access the system. And also, we have to keep the workers that are trying to rebuild those transportation systems safe. There's a recent report that was put out by the Associated General Contractors of America that said 67% of nation's road contractors experienced some form of a vehicle crash at their work sites. Mm-hmm.
And there have been a number of people that have been killed as the I-4 project has been going on in Florida. I also want to get to the point that you just made about allowing people to use the roads while the construction is going on. There was a project near our studios here, and they actually shut down a major highway for 2 weeks during the summer for 2 years in a row to get this bridge put in because it was a much faster way to do it, to just say nobody can drive on this road right now for these 2 weeks rather than having slow traffic for a year while they worked on it.
Absolutely. And I think engineers and contractors are trying to be more innovative in the ways they think about addressing some of these problems. And that's a good example of a way to do it. There's a certain inconvenience right during those 2 weeks, but the rest of the year, the project is open. The bridge is open to normal traffic. You know, we're facing that right now, not with a roadway system, but in Washington, D.C., the metro line is closed south of National Airport. Those people that are listening may know some of that transit system.
And they're probably complaining about it right now because they want it to be open.
It's the first 3 or 4 days. They're closing that through the entire summer. It's going to open back up on September 6th. Mm-hmm. It is causing some angst, I guess, as people try and get from south of the airport into Washington, D.C. to work. It's adding congestion to the roadway system because buses are now taking people. It is one of those things where, you know, we've taken that generation off of investing in the transit system, much like we did the roadway system. And so we're having to make those repairs. And it was better or more convenient, if that makes sense, to close it for the summer, mm-hmm. when volume may be a little less because people are on vacation and traveling and things like that, than it would be to close it, you know, 1 weekend at a time.
Well, so let's get to another thing that you just brought up, which is that there are so many more cars on these roads that were built decades ago than they were designed for. I saw one statistic that there was an interstate highway that was built for 70,000 cars, and now there are 200,000 or 250,000 cars on that same freeway. Are we ever going to be able to build enough highways for all of the cars that are going to be in this country? Or is it time to start thinking about, rather than expanding the old highways, building more public transit and finding other ways to get people from place to place?
You know, the short answer to your question is no, we will not be able to build enough highways. We cannot build our way out of some of the congestion. And that is rather clear. I grew up in Los Angeles. We will not build our way out of congestion in Los Angeles. That is not possible. And what Los Angeles has done, I think, is an interesting example, clearly a car culture in mm-hmm. Los Angeles, is They are investing very heavily, not only in rebuilding some of their roadway systems, but they're investing heavily in transit. And they're actually trying to provide people additional options for mobility. We need to start rethinking how we're going to get from point A to B. We need to start thinking about maybe even how close we live to where we work.
And does everybody really need to go into work every day, or could a lot of the people in this country be working from home?
And that's another good point. I mean, I think companies and businesses need to start thinking about whether or not telecommuting is an option for some employees for some days. You may not always be allowed to not be in the office, if you will, right? But the ability to telecommute 1 or 2 days a week can certainly relieve congestion. We see that in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Absolutely.
I want to ask you about the money here, because these projects to upgrade highways these days, it's much more expensive than it used to be. It can be billions of dollars just for a mile or two. Where's that money going to come from, especially because lawmakers have been so reluctant to raise things like the gas tax to put money into our highways?
Well, I think that's, you know, we've been working for years. I hazard to say how many years, but many years trying to figure out this, the riddle of how we actually start paying for our surface transportation system in a more effective manner. You know, right now, ASCE and lots of other groups support actually increasing the federal motor fuels tax. It sits at 18.3 cents a gallon. So regardless of how much your gas costs per gallon, you're still just paying 18 cents into the roadway system. That hasn't been raised since 1993. You know, my sort of quick answer to folks is, would you like to live on your 1993 wage? Most people don't. And so I think, you know, one of the things we can do is certainly raise the motor fuels tax. That would be on for diesel and for gasoline. Mm-hmm. So truckers would pay as well. As we look further into the future, there will be the opportunity to actually charge drivers per mile that they drive. This tends to be a little bit controversial, and some folks have pause with that notion. But the reality is, it is a fair way to do it. We see more electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles being utilized, and they're actually not paying into the system at all. So if you see people driving around in a Tesla, which is all electric vehicle, they pay nothing into the highway trust fund. And sort of the real premise that we focus on is this idea that the user should pay.
So more tolls is what it sounds like you're saying.
We look at it more as the user can pay in a number of different ways. You could have this vehicle mile travel fee, the mileage-based user fee, if you will. You could increase the gas tax. You could put a fee on electric vehicles and utilize that as well. Some states are using tolling. Tolls can be beneficial in certain areas. We have, you know, a large country and a large interstate highway system. There is some stretches of the interstate highway system that are not as congested as those in Boston or Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles. And tolling is maybe not an option in those areas. So I think tolling needs to be on the list, but it's probably not at the top of the list.
I remember driving from Los Angeles to New York, and I didn't pay any tolls all the way across. And as soon as I got to Washington, D.C., it was just toll all the way up to New York.
That Washington to New York stretch has a few tolls on it.
That's Brian Palish, who's Managing Director of Government Relations at the American Society of Civil Engineers. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump's threat last week to levy tariffs on Mexico is just the latest news to spook the markets. The Dow has lost almost 7% of its value in the past month, and bond rates have fallen as investors flee to safety. Economists are worried about an increased risk of recession by the end of next year. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So there's a new survey out today from the National Association for Business Economists, which estimates a 15% risk of recession this year and a 60% risk by the end of 2020. What are the factors that are concerning economists about where we are?
Well, I think number one is the increased trade protectionist. That's what they cite as the primary downside risk. But there's also other pieces of this. Financial market strains, meaning that, hey, we've been rising for a while. And even though we've lost, as you said, 6-7% in the month of May, markets are still higher. And also a general global growth slowdown. So that adds to all of the mix of potential worries around recession.
But that said, when you look at a lot of the measures of the economy, including the unemployment rate, which is down at, what, 3.6% or something like that, the economy has been growing strongly despite all of these issues. What do you think could tip it?
You know, it could be sheer exhaustion. If you think about it, next month, this economy, which has been expanding for almost 10 years, mm-hmm. will actually become the longest expansion on record. So obviously, the further you get into the process, the more likely it is that it corrects at some point. And also that, generally speaking, last year we had that strong growth, but it really was attributable to the one-time impact of those tax increases. So a lot of economists that I've been speaking to, not the ones from this survey specifically, have said to me, 2020, that's kind of what we're penciling in. But no one knows. This is all right. A guesstimate, frankly.
Okay. The New York Times is reporting today that last week President Trump considered imposing tariffs on Australia. Of course, he actually did say he was imposing them on Mexico. It now sounds like the Australian tariffs are going to be put on hold, at least temporarily. But as you look at the tariffs on China and Mexico and other places, how much are those hurting the economy right now?
You know, I don't see huge signs that there is a big dent in the economy because of this. I mean, we might say that, gee, had the tariffs not been in place or the threat of tariffs not out there, that we would be growing by even more. But it's hard to prove a negative. What we do know is that these tariffs create uncertainty. And that is certainly something that business leaders are very concerned about. I spoke to one woman who said to me, look, I was thinking about adding 1,000 people to my payrolls this year. Now I'm rethinking it because now I don't know when tariffs can come out of the blue for non-economic reasons like they just did last week with Mexico.
How do you expect the Federal Reserve will react to what's going on in the markets and the economy right now?
Well, I think we have a clear message from Jerome Powell and company, and that is that at the moment that there is any weakness, I think this Fed is ready to cut. And it's not going to be because of the president and what the president says. It's just that these Fed governors are very sensitive to an economic slowdown. I think the likelihood is we actually could see a Fed rate cut this year. Put it on the tape. Mark it right there, Jeremy.
We'll come back and see if you're right. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
The sound of Velcro as Mike Steiner from Corgan, the architecture and design firm based in Dallas, Texas, puts on an age simulation suit, weighted vest, restraints on joints, eye and ear covers to muffle sound and blur sight. He looks like a goalie for the Boston Bruins or the St. Louis Blues, but he feels like an old man. Now, what are you feeling when you get up? Slowly. You got up slowly.
Got up slowly. You have to concentrate a little bit harder, especially with the overshoes. You really don't have a firm sense of where the ground actually is. And I'm really having to concentrate on your words because of the hearing loss.
Wow. And now also, are you concerned about where you're going?
Yes. Obviously, the things I can see in the near distance, I want to make sure that I'm steering clear of the chairs. I don't want to trip and fall.
We're in our conference room, hardly a danger zone, but Mike and his colleague Samantha Flores have worn these outfits at sites like airports to see how to better design them for the elderly. We'll have pictures at hearandnow.org.
Describe what you've got on.
So it's a series of straps that reduce your mobility, and it's a series of weights that simulate what happens when you age. You actually lose muscle mass, so your body feels heavier. So these are elbow braces that mimic reduced movement in my elbow joint itself. As you age, you lose dexterity in your fingers. So those gloves simulate the loss of dexterity.
Your feet, what's on your feet?
So we've got weights at the extremities, both at my wrists and at my ankles. So that helps make your body feel like your limbs are heavier. And under my shoes are what's called overshoes. These simulate some of the nerve loss that you get as you age. You lose the nerve contacts that you have at the bottom of your feet that tell you where the ground is.
And it looks like you've got ski goggles in your hands.
These goggles simulate general vision loss.
Okay, and a headphone.
Earmuffs. And as hearing loss continues, you're able to hear less and less. So the suit itself is approximately 30 pounds, and then there are about 5 pounds at each wrist. And 10 pounds at each leg.
I want to ask Samantha, You've worn this in airports, up and down escalators, you know, trying to get to a gate, you're nodding. What are some of the things you encountered when you were trying to research the layout of airports?
Well, the first thing that I noticed is that it takes a longer time to get to different places, and so the need to rest and to sit is very impactful. Have more benches, have more places for someone to grab onto. You know, typically we design these concourses to be wide open spaces so that multiple people can move, but there's not really a place to grab onto if you've lost your balance or if you just need a moment to rest.
This suit was created by a company in Germany. Mike, you're the one who said, hey, maybe we can use it as a design tool. And you did a couple studies. You went to an elementary school, an airport, a medical building, and Corgan's headquarters. Three researchers, 50 volunteers from your company, designers and architects. What are some of the other things, Samantha, that you saw and said something has to be done about this?
Well, we not only use the age suit, we also pair a lot of our information that we gather from the age suit with our focus groups and working with passengers with reduced mobility, reduced hearing loss, or visual impairment, and use the age suit to help us understand the nuances that these people are talking about in the focus groups.
Well, and I understand, Mike, some of the things you all saw, the elderly tend to look down a lot because they're just looking ahead of them. They don't want to fall, so they may miss signs.
Yeah, so the shininess of the floor tend to draw people's attention down. People that have fallen once are a lot more focused on not falling again.
Oh, my hand is fiercely up. A shiny floor was my nemesis because it turned out to be black ice. Now you always look at the floor.
Yeah, so not only just the sheen on the floor, but sometimes the light fixtures above can kind of disorient folks as they walk through the space. Obviously, as architects, we're very cognizant of transition changes because that's a code requirement. But knowing that there will be circumstances where we need to use ramps, we want to be very cognizant that those are kind of delineated as best we can so they don't catch people by surprise.
Or put directions on the floor.
Correct. Passengers tend to look at the floor if they're higher up in the age bracket. And so what we've noticed is that if we can put medallions or different directional elements close to the ground, that actually helps them identify zones. For instance, in DFW Terminal A, we've placed medallions in the floor that have helped certain passengers understand, okay, this is where the Skylink is and I need to make this decision to turn here.
What about escalators?
When we tried the age suit out in the airport, it is difficult to get onto the escalator if it's a two-step escalator. So we started recommending three-step escalators in all of our public spaces and airports.
What does that mean, three steps?
That means that it gives you an extra step that's flat before it starts descending down.
You know, here you are in this suit. Were you ever, like, scared or feeling tentative? Well, Samantha, you're nodding yes.
I was a little timid because it reduces your speed. It makes you feel like you're about to get run over.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that we really took away from the staff that ran through the scenarios is that having the hearing and the sight losses is really isolating. So even though I was at the airport, I did not have a flight to catch. I couldn't understand half of the announcements. The losses that you have can be a little bit overwhelming.
You can get caught. You can maybe see somebody crossing in front of you and not realize they have their bag, and then you've gone over their bag. Wow, why hasn't somebody come up with a suitcase that's a walker that you could lean on? But anyway, that's my idea, and I want credit for it. Can I try that on? Let's try this. Hold on. Off comes the vest. Is this a relief?
Well, I've pre-warmed it for you.
Yeah. It's sweaty. It's definitely... Now, you just put a neck brace on. Is that because of the limited neck mobility?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, again, like the joints in your neck will lose their mobility, and that neck brace kind of simulates that.
God. My arms, I can't lift them.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
There you go. Put your elbow in here.
Oh, the feet. I can't believe how hard it is to raise my feet.
So I'll have to put the gloves on. There you go.
Wow. All
right. One more strap.
Like I'm under mud.
There we go. All right.
Oh, that is so hard to walk. That's sad. You know, and I think that's what it's like for someone. That's sad. Okay. Phew. And it's muted, and I feel like I'm looking at you through gauze.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh.
Try it.
Very hard. Yeah, I can't imagine moving through an airport feeling like this. Okay. So what are some of the design solutions, Samantha?
Well, some of the solutions that we've been able to implement in airports is making sure that we put wayfinding signage at a specific location.
Wayfinding, finding your way.
Finding your way, yes. Gate pylons are a huge benefit. So even if you can't see as far as the gate that you're trying to reach, you can see a delineation, and it helps to reduce stress because you know that you can count as far as that next gate. We've also tried to include daylighting within our terminals to help reduce a lot of the glare, and then also looking at electrochromic glass for the hold room so that we don't create a lot of glare on the ground as well.
With some of the other solutions, we understand get restrooms out of high traffic areas so you don't have to fight, right, you know, the flow of people to get to them. And we love these. We've actually featured these glasses that the blind or the visually impaired can put on, and you can contact a guide, and that guide can talk to you and tell you what you're seeing. I think they're called ERA glasses. They see what you see or actually can't see.
Well, and even for those that aren't have that level of disability, airports are starting to gravitate towards turn-by-turn navigation within their facilities. So, like, imagine Google Maps or Apple Maps. You know, you need to turn left to get to Concourse H, and your destination will be 300 feet on the left.
Oh, that's fabulous. Has this changed how you look at the elderly?
Sort of. And I say that because I happen to be blessed with a family that has had a lot of people in the 90s to 100s. Something like this has made it more accessible to kind of our industry.
I mean, you had to have a sensitivity to start with, Samantha, I would think. It was just what I'm hearing from Mike. How about you?
Right. I mean, having a friend that has gone through having multiple sclerosis and understanding that to get her on a trip with us is a challenge. She has to plan months in advance. She's not in a wheelchair. She doesn't have a cane. She has a disability that people just don't understand. Just knowing this really helps you to understand a little bit more empathy whenever you're designing.
That's Samantha Flores, along with Mike Steiner of the architecture and design firm Corgan.
Next month, researchers representing 22 colleges will hold their 7th annual Traumatic Brain Injury Summit. It's part of their collaborative effort to better understand the causes and effects of sports-related head injuries. What gets less attention, but are also concerning, are heat-related deaths in college football players. Since 2000, 30 players have died as a result of the hot weather. Now Congress is paying attention because of what happened to one teenager at a small college in Kansas. Sam Zeff of member station KCUR reports.
19-year-old Braden Bradforth, a 6'3", 300-pound lineman, lived for football.
He knew stats of current college players, previous college players, professional players. Like, he lived to watch old football films.
That's his mom, Joanne Atkins Ingram, from the New Jersey shore town of Neptune. Late last July, she put her youngest son on a plane to Garden City Community College in the southwest corner of Kansas. Bradforth was, she said, following his dream of playing college football and going to the NFL.
He said, no, I'm really going to make it. And he said, I'm going to make, you know, a lot of money, and then I'm going to buy you a house. And, you know, the typical dreams that boys have.
But 2 days later, Bradforth was dead from a heat stroke that an autopsy attributed to overexertion. It was the second practice of the season, and he was made to run 36 50-yard sprints at a temperature and altitude he wasn't used to. It was an evening practice, but it was still in the mid-80s. And, according to multiple players, the team was denied water until after the grueling workout.
How could this happen to him when all he was doing was following his passion?
One reason, says Scott Anderson, is some football coaches just push their players too hard.
There's absolutely no reason for an offensive defensive lineman to be out there sprinting, you know, sometimes sprinting at a mile or near mile in a short period of time, essentially doing a skill player workout.
Anderson, the head trainer at the University of Oklahoma, has been trying to make football practices safer his entire career.
There has to be a progression of activity. You just can't throw somebody in an intense day one or two workout, for instance, and call that good science of sport.
Anderson's former colleague at OU, heatstroke expert Dr. Randy Eichner, calls college football a warrior culture and says heatstroke deaths are 100% preventable. Dr. Francis O'Connor, who teaches medicine at Uniformed Services University and is an Army Medical Corps veteran, agrees. He says no athlete should be forced into the kind of workout Bradford had on his first day.
But what I want to really bring your attention to is the acclimatization strategy here. It's 1 to 2 weeks. It takes time. It's not 2 days.
In addition to the 30 college football players who died from heat-related illness since 2000, so did another 47 high school players in roughly the same time period. That's according to the National Center for Catastrophic Sport Injury Research at the University of North Carolina. But it appears the Bradford case is shining a light on these deaths.
I don't know. It was just, if you really did know Braden or knew of him, or if you was a friend of a friend, you would understand.
Last month, 100 family and friends gathered at Friendship Baptist Church in Asbury Park, New Jersey, in support of Bradford's mom, Joanne, and her family. Joining them, Republican New Jersey Congressman Chris Smith.
It's heartbreaking beyond words that a guy that had great hopes and expectations of playing in the NFL someday, on the first day of practice, dies from exertional heat exhaustion.
In a letter to the president of the college, Smith, with the entire New Jersey House delegation, called for an independent investigation. In response, the college's board of trustees approved $100,000 to pay for an independent probe. In addition, Bradford's death has prompted House Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Frank Pallone, also from New Jersey, to ask the CDC to brief committee staff on what that agency is doing to prevent heat stroke deaths. Pallone is also considering holding a committee hearing. Ann Smith says he's working on legislation to create a commission to study the broader issue of heat deaths in college football.
It would have the insight of experts who really know, medical doctors who are working in this field, trainers, coaches, players, so that they really come up with a list of recommendations that will save lives.
Garden City Community College did release a page and a half summary of an internal investigation into Bradford's death. No conclusions were released, but the college said it will train all coaches in CPR and develop a protocol for treating heat-related illnesses. As for Bradford's mom, Joanne Atkins Ingram says she struggles with her son's death every day, and she's working to make sure no more college football players die from intense practices.
So moving forward, that is my goal, is to keep anybody else from dying from something that is preventable.
For Here and Now, I'm Sam Zeff.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.